Hey, I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
More than 2,200 people experiencing homelessness are in hotel and motel rooms paid for by the state of Vermont. That number includes more than 500 children. The Emergency Motel Housing Program expanded during the pandemic, and this past legislative session, lawmakers set new limits on the program to rein in costs. The new limits will come to bear in just a few weeks. In a bit, we're going to hear from leaders at two shelters in the state on how they're preparing for these changes. But first, we're joined by Carly Berlin. She covers housing and infrastructure for Vermont Public and VT Digger, and she's been reporting on the Emergency Motel Housing Program for a while now. Carly, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Carly, let's begin at the beginning here. Can you remind us of just the very basics of the Emergency Motel Housing Program?
Yeah, so the state provides vouchers for unhoused people to stay in motel and hotel rooms when traditional homeless shelters are full, which they usually are. Mm-hmm. People have to meet specific requirements to get in, like they're a family with kids, they have a disability, or they just went through a natural disaster like a flood.
Okay. And this program expanded considerably during the pandemic, right?
Yes. So during the pandemic, this opened up, the state opened up eligibility requirements, essentially giving a room to anyone experiencing homelessness. The idea here was to give people space to social distance outside of crowded shelters as a, you know, public health intervention.
Yeah. And who was paying for it?
So at the time, the federal government was footing the bill for this, you know, for years, really, with pandemic relief aid. That money ran out last year.
Okay. So since the pandemic, the legislature has extended this program with state funding for vulnerable households a couple of times now. It seems to have sort of like expanded and contracted a little bit over the past few years. More recently, they have really started to try to rein in the program. What are the new rules that are being put in place?
Yes. So there's a new limit on the number of days someone can have a voucher for. So that's 80 days for the year. Okay. That'll be lifted during the winter months. So it's functionally 80 days during the warmer months of the year. State officials had openly speculated whether people in the program would ration their 80 days throughout the year or use them all in one go. Based on the numbers we have right now, it looks like people are generally staying put. This day limit went into effect on July 1st, which was the beginning of the state fiscal year. 80 days from then is September 19th. So I was talking to Miranda Gray, a deputy commissioner for the Department for Children and Families recently. She told me that if people don't leave over the next couple of weeks, DCF anticipates that about a third of the households in the program right now will use up their 80 days by the 19th.
Wow. Okay. A third of households. That seems significant.
Yes, exactly. There are about 1,400 households in the program right now.
Okay.
But there's also another limit coming into effect here. That is a limit on the total number of rooms the state is going to pay for going forward. So lawmakers put a cap in place. That will go into effect on September 15th. It's an 1,100-room cap, also going to be lifted during the winter. No cap like that exists right now. And a few weeks out from the cap going into effect, the program is oversubscribed by about 300 households. So 1,400 households now, 1,100-room cap coming into effect in a couple of weeks here.
Okay, so about 300 people in limbo there.
Yes.
Let's recap here. There's the 80-day per household cap.
Yep.
For the year, excluding winter months. And then the state has a total number of rooms that it'll pay for at a given time. So with these folks that are, they're kind of in limbo, who are saying, hey, you know, I have a voucher, I can use this, but, you know, the state is saying, nope, we've hit our cap. What do they do? How does the state prioritize these people?
Exactly. So DCF is, looking for a way to prioritize basically the most vulnerable among the vulnerable right now. Oof. So they, when these policies go into effect by September 15th, they're anticipating they're going to have more people currently in the program who are eligible for rooms than it can legally shelter anymore because of the room cap. you know, even if the clock on people stays is going to run out kind of shortly after this fall, there's a bit of a timing problem here. But so the department has come up with a prioritization policy that's going to kick in basically anytime the motel program is close to full capacity, to basically, you know, assess who should get access to a room when a limited number of rooms are available. Priority access is going to go to families with kids ages 19 and under, people who are pregnant, people experiencing domestic violence, other types of violence, and people over the age of 65. And then people over the age of 50 who also meet another criteria, like they have a disability or they've experienced a natural disaster, they've been evicted, they're also going to get priority. That leaves out younger people without kids who have disabilities or, you know, meet one of these other boxes. Advocates have been raising the alarm about, you know, people on oxygen who could get left outside or end up in the emergency room and frankly, be at risk of death if they lose a room.
Oh, okay. So a lot of tough choices coming down the pike. Carly, do we know what Governor Scott thinks of these new limits, this new plan?
Yeah, so the governor has long advocated shrinking the motel program, but even he criticized the room cap proposal during the legislative session, saying it might inhibit Vermonters in need of help. That comment came as a surprise to a lot of observers at the time, but he did sign all of this into law as part of this year's budget. I will also say his, you know, Governor Scott's DCF commissioner, Chris Winters, you know, back during the session had expressed his, a desire for lawmakers to give some more clarity around who to prioritize when motel room spots became more limited. Mm. But the law ultimately offered very little guidance when it came down to it.
Okay. Well, you have talked to not just lawmakers, but a lot of people who are in the motel housing program right now, including a woman named Mary, who you mentioned, who's in Waterbury. Could you tell us a little bit about Mary?
Yeah. So I met Mary Mojica at a motel in Colchester a couple of weeks ago. She has been there with her dog, Bella, since her rental in Waterbury flooded last summer. Mm. She's been trying to find an apartment she can afford on her disability income, but her search keeps coming up short. And she's really worried about what's going to happen when her 80 days run out this fall. She can't afford to pay to stay at the motel until the day limit is lifted in the winter. You know, she was like, maybe I could pay October, November, but that's prohibitively expensive. And so she's worried that she could end up in a tent outside. Hmm.
And in just a moment, we're going to be talking with folks from local shelters about this issue. I remember speaking to some folks who run shelters last summer when we were also seeing a downsizing of the motel housing program. And they were giving out tents to people because that was the only option for finding housing. And Carly, I think I remember from your reporting that it could also just take a really long time for unhoused people to find permanent housing, even if they are actively searching for it and they might have some money on hand to be able to put, you know, a down payment on rent or something like that. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, when I was talking to Mary at the Colchester Days Inn a few weeks ago, she told me that she'd recently gotten in touch with an aid agency who said it would be 10 weeks before they could assign her a housing worker. She was like, I don't have 10 weeks. I've got to be out here, you know, in a couple of days. You know, advocates really pushed back against this day limit in particular during the legislative session, saying, you know, it takes a lot longer for people to find housing than 80 days. You know, statewide, the majority of unhoused people are unable to get into housing for at least 181 days. In Chittenden County, that number is a lot higher. So, you know, that puts people in a really tight spot as they try to find another alternative right now.
Mm. You bring up advocates for people experiencing homelessness, but pushing back on some of these changes. Have they put forth other ideas, or is the main thing, you know, an ask for more state funding to keep the motel program going?
I think it's tough. I mean, I think right now, like you were saying earlier, you know, advocates and service providers are really in a sort of triage mode.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of pushback during the final weeks of the session against the room cap, against the day limit cap. But right now, there's not a whole lot that advocates can change. These limits have been signed into law. And so I think what we're going to be seeing here over the next couple of weeks is this sort of triage posture. How do we help people who just simply don't have another place to go?
Yeah. Well, ahead of today's show, we asked you, our listeners, for your ideas on what you think your community could do to address the affordable housing shortage and help folks who are experiencing homelessness. We got an email from Sylvia in Linden who writes, I walk frequently on the Vermont State University Linden campus. During the school year, the parking lot for the residential halls is about 1/5 full, leading me to believe that much of the residential housing is not used. My guess is that there is a similar situation on other campuses, with both a downturn in college admissions and with the push to get VSU students to use remote learning. Why not use the empty space to house homeless people? I'm curious what you think of this suggestion, Carly. Is there a push to use maybe residential campuses, other, you know, large buildings around the state as temporary shelters at least?
Yeah, I think that's a really creative idea, and it's not one that I've heard really entertained at the State House. I think that, you know, we need all of the solutions that we can get right now to, you know, address the crisis that we're seeing across the state. So I definitely think, you know, looking at places where we have vacant buildings that are underused is certainly, you know, worth thinking about.
Yeah. Carly, another question I have for you about this and the timing in particular is, you know, as you've mentioned, these limits are coming up in the middle of September, and then things shift in the winter months. The state has a program to house more people during the winter months. They have more money that goes towards it. Does that mean that there are going to be families or individuals who have to move out of a room and then maybe even like a month or two later, once it gets cold, move right back in?
Yeah.
Seems kind of inefficient in a way.
It is, you know, right. This over the course of this year, we're going to see the program sort of expand and contract and expand and contract. And that's really hard to keep track of for, you know, me as a reporter. It's, you know, surely hard to keep track of if you're someone trying to get a roof over your head. Like I said earlier, both the room cap and the day limit cap are going to be lifted this winter. But actually eligibility for a voucher will still be limited to people who meet one of the state's vulnerability criteria. That is a change from the last couple of years when basically anyone experiencing homelessness could get a voucher in the winter. Idea being, let's get people inside during really cold weather. This year, that will be limited to people who meet, you know, a vulnerability criteria set by the state. I heard a lot of concern about that during the legislative session from advocates as well. Lawmakers' answer to that was putting aside a pot of money specifically for temporary warming shelters across the state. That was $10 million for temporary shelters that would just operate during the winter months, December through March, I believe. We should be getting more information soon about where exactly those will be, and we'll see if there's, you know, enough capacity to meet the need that we see this winter.
Well, there are so many stories to tell on this subject, Carly. I know you've been following as many as you possibly can for both Vermont Public and VT Digger. What other stories are you working on or questions that you're looking into right now?
Yeah, so I am currently working on an episode of Vermont Public's Brave Little State podcast that's going to come out next week. I regularly get people reaching out to me asking, how many homeless people in Vermont are from here? I get that question probably more than anything else I write about.
Huh. So how many are from here, the state of Vermont, versus coming in from outside of the state?
Exactly. I get that question so frequently that I pitched the Brave Little State team to let me investigate it for a podcast episode. Been toiling away at that for the last, really couple of months. That's going to come out next week. So listen up for it.
Yeah, we certainly will. Carly Berlin covers housing and infrastructure for Vermont Public and VT Digger. Carly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We are joined now by folks who help run two shelters in our region. Rick DeAngelis is the former executive director of Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie. He's now partially retired, but still serves as an advisor to the current executive director. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so very much. I'm really glad to be back on the show.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. We are also joined today by Michael Redman. He is the executive director of Upper Valley Haven, which is based in White River Junction. Michael, welcome.
Thanks, Michaela. Glad to be here. Hey, Rick. Good to hear your voice, too.
Yeah, same here, Michael.
Rick and Michael, I'm hoping you could both help us start out this conversation by describing the places where you work, what they look like, and the space they occupy in your community. Rick, let's start with you.
Yeah, sure thing. Well, we operate three shelters year-round, and we also operate a seasonal shelter that's going to open this year in October. And there will be, this year, 81 beds in total in those four shelters. Two of the shelters are congregate, meaning that people are in bunk beds and in rooms. And then two of the shelters are what I would describe as semi-congregate. So they're usually shared rooms. And we also work in one of the larger hotels here in Washington County.
How full are the beds typically?
100%. I mean, there's turnover, you know, from week to week of a few rooms, but generally we're at a very, very high occupancy level.
And Michael, describe Upper Valley Haven for us, please.
Sure. We're a slightly smaller organization. We operate two shelters year-round. One is a family shelter that can accommodate eight families, and then an adult shelter, which can accommodate 20 adults in 10 rooms. So it's shared occupancy. These shelters are not the drop-in model. They are where you come in, and if you're in, you're in until you leave with housing or you make other plans. This winter, we'll also, in Lebanon, because we're right across the border from New Hampshire, operate a 14-bed shelter there for the winter that will be open to residents of Vermont, though it has some priority for New Hampshire residents.
And as we were just discussing with reporter Carly Berlin, there are more changes coming to the state's emergency motel housing program. First, Rick, I'm wondering if you could describe for us the amount of overlap there is, in your opinion, between folks who stay at shelters like the ones Good Samaritan Haven runs and folks who are in the emergency motel housing program. Is it generally the same folks?
Generally, yes. There's a very close relationship between the two. The only difference for us is that we don't serve families in our shelters, and we do have quite a few families in motels in Washington County. I don't have the number right in front of me, but there's over 50 children living in motels room right now in the county. So, yeah, whatever happens there, it's going to impact us in the shelter. But as I just said, there's no room in the shelter. So Carly had it exactly right. It's triage mode. And we're going to be looking at every solution we can to keep people, sheltered and safe. And that goes from buying bus tickets to providing them with a tent.
And Michael, what does triage mode look like for you?
Yeah, so I think I want to add an additional complication, which I know Rick will experience as well, is that in addition to the shelters and to folks staying in motels, and I agree there's a lot of overlap, but I'm going to make a distinction, but there's also a number of people that are already living outside who we see every day coming in for showers, for food, and also services to help them in various ways, including camping equipment. What we're seeing too is that those in our district, there's 61 households staying in motels currently. 10 of those households have children. Most of the others have eligibility through a disability, which Carly mentioned, which includes mental health and physical disability. But what we're seeing in both our shelters and in the motel program and outside is that the complexity of the folks that are needing emergency housing through one means or another is extensive. Older populations, more with chronic health conditions, some needing personal care, which is beyond our capacity typically, and mental health issues and often paired with substance use that's challenging too. So the triage is it's a tough set that we're dealing with both internally in the shelters and in the motel programs where we do outreach, as does Rick, and those who are already living outside in their cars, under bridges, out in the woods.
Hmm. What you just said, Michael, reminds me of an email we got ahead of today's show from a listener who writes, in Burlington, homeless folks that are in recovery or desperately trying to get sober have nowhere designated specifically to receive housing and support services. If we want people to get sober, we must provide housing and support. Michael, do you feel like there is a place that you could recommend to folks who are trying to get sober? Are those places full too?
Yeah, there's always a choice of limits and allocation.
Sure.
And we use what's called a harm reduction approach in our shelters we're not a dry shelter. We encourage people to maintain passive sobriety, and we were very supportive of those who are there. But we also believe that it's better that people are inside than outside, particularly those that are more vulnerable due to age and those health conditions that I was speaking to. There are some shelters that are dry, and that can be found. But our approach has been to be more tolerant of that, but work with people where they are, because it's going to take them to decide what their path might be. And we can help people who are working on sobriety and at this time.
Hmm. Rick, do you feel the same? Are there places that you can recommend to people if they are interested in trying to get sober and that might be affecting their search for housing?
Well, that's a huge issue. It is so right for that listener to raise that. Yes, people can, there are options for inpatient recovery, but the problem is when someone gets out of that recovery program, and they have to go back to the shelter or on the streets, it's really, really tough. It places so much stress on them to continue with their recovery. We do operate one of our shelters as what we call a recovery-oriented shelter, meaning that these are individuals who have started their recovery process, they are experiencing homelessness, and we do have a shelter specifically for that that gives them support to continue in that process. So, but we need so much more. I mean, we only have 13 beds in that shelter. We could use 100 beds like that.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. We have Nils in Duxbury calling in. Nils, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Great show, as always. I have spoken at one point with one of the people that manages Habitat for Humanity. And the question I have, I've got to find a place to stop. The question I have is simple. There are homes here and about abandoned or perhaps in foreclosure that sit, and I can name four or five in the community I live in. It would seem to me that if we're hell bent on increasing the housing stock, and at some level that's going to reduce or have a positive impact on the homelessness thing, that we should be working at doing that. And I don't know who out there is what agency or nonprofit group could be able to take that on, but I've worked on Habitat projects. I know they're very well organized and supported, but it's always new construction.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if either of your guests have any ideas or response to that, and I'll happily hang up the phone and listen off the air.
Thanks. So Nils had a question about potentially turning homes that are in foreclosure into places that could be used as shelters, temporary shelters. Rick, Michael, have either of you heard of any efforts like this? Rick?
Yeah, they're... Oh, Rick, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, Michael, you continue, and then I'll add in if I need to.
Okay. Yeah, there is, the state of Vermont has been not sitting on its hands while this is, this challenge is occurring. The burst of ARPA funding and Vermont funding, there's a lot going on in to add to the housing stock, because after all, that is what is going to fix the issue. Motel program, while it has provided some useful service over a period of time, it is not a long-term solution. In fact, it causes additional problems of lack of ability to deal with people in the moment and over time, where a shelter can provide that. So through several programs at the state, there is money to repair housing, to bring it up to code, to add it to the stock. And it's hundreds of units have come on in this way. I also, you know, point out that VHCB, the Vermont Housing Conservation Board, which manages the addition of both permanent housing and shelter, has dedicated now 25% of its new housing coming online to people who are unhoused. Here in Hartford, we have 100 units of affordable housing coming on this year because of ARPA funding. And we have 30 units that are designated for the Haven to help place people who are unhoused. And it's with funding from the state of Vermont, it's coming with services. And that is, I wanted to add, the most important thing, or as part of not the most important, the housing is most important, but to add services to that we call supportive housing will lead to lasting change over time. And so we're really pleased that these 30 units that we're going to have case managers working in is going to lead to permanent change, which I think can also affect the community and its perceptions about what works and what doesn't work.
Hmm. Let's try to squeeze in a couple more ideas from folks on the phones as well. Timothy in Ferrisburg is on the line. Timothy, go ahead.
Yes, I mostly wanted to commend the young woman that called in mentioning the collegiate resources,
mm-hmm.
you know, for housing.
Yes, we received, for listeners who didn't hear, we received an email earlier in the show that our guest commented upon. The email was suggesting that we use residential housing that is currently sitting empty at university campuses for temporary housing and shelter. Go ahead, Timothy.
And I just work with Medicare and Medicaid and local regional planning for housing. And I'm amazed sometimes at the amount of attention that's being paid now, while, you know, our only domestic insurance company is basically looking at insolvency, and where the funding is coming for this. If it's federal, that's great, but you don't really see the entire state demographic going up. So I have to ask myself, in these small communities, this just is not a... when I say the small communities, I mean the small towns of Vermont having to shoulder the cost right now, given the amount of people that have been displaced by flooding.
Yeah.
I can't wrap my head around where the money's coming from.
Timothy, I'm going to jump in here only because I want to get in one more caller, but I hear your concern there about shouldering the costs of programs, especially when the state's demographics are changing and there might be more needs for other social services, especially to support older Vermonters. Many needs out there as well. Let's go to one more caller. We have Kevin in Danby on the line. Kevin, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My comment kind of piggybacks off not the previous caller, but the caller before, because I went on a ride one day and I went through this town and I must have come across a dozen farmhouses that were just empty. It didn't look like they'd been used in years. And it's like, could we incentivize people to be able to the state or any to sell these things, and then we could get people into them, and the people who could go into them, maybe they could be taught how to fix and take care of your stuff, so you have ownership of things. I don't know. I mean, in every town and city has empty homes.
Yeah.
And it's just a shame that they're rotting into the ground before we could be repurposed. And then even if we got people moving out of the cities into more rural areas, these rural towns would have essentially a better tax base without necessarily changing the complete demographics of a place either.
Right.
I don't know. It's just an idea.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin, for calling in. Speaking about older homes that could be updated to house folks who need it. Rick, there seems to be a lot of interest in this topic, a lot of ideas and enthusiasm, and yet the problem persists. What is there one thing that you think, just to help us close out here, incentive or change, something that people could keep an eye on or push for in this next legislative session that could kind of start to help us move the ball forward?
Well, I'd want to say that I think more and more about this problem as a worldwide problem. There's 150 million people homeless worldwide. There's 650,000 homeless in the United States. So it's a big and complex issue, but it doesn't mean we have to be paralyzed. We just need to keep focused and keep working on it as best we can at this level and advocating for changes. I love the sentiment of reusing resources we have in the state, not only old farmhouses. How about office buildings that are empty now because of the change in the office market? There are resources out there. There are buildings. We just got to keep the focus and keep pushing to build more housing and to provide the services that people need.
Mm. We also got an email from Kenny just now, who lives in Montpelier, and says there are dorm rooms and empty office buildings, which are well-maintained and heated, and surely, Kenny writes, some of them could be used for housing. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for today, though there are many, many more threads to pull out and untangle from this conversation around homelessness and housing in our state. We will return to them soon. Our guests today were Rick DeAngelis of Good Samaritan Haven and Michael Redman from Upper Valley Haven. Michael, Rick, thank you both so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Michaela. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really important topic, and appreciate your focus on it.